Time for Ask the Pharmacist, and our resident pharmacist, Elizabeth Roddick, joins us from New Life Pharmacy. Hello.
Hello, Simon.
Nice to see you again. And we've got lots of stuff to get through, as always, so we'll get straight on with it. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, I think the National Health Service in England is considering limiting a lot of commonly prescribed products. Now, have you heard about this?
Yeah, this is a consultation by NHS England, and it closes on the 21st of October. It's about suggesting that certain products shouldn't be prescribed in primary care. Homeopathy products, things like travel vaccines, fentanyl patches. Now, these are patches really you apply once a week for pain. Probably of more interest, though, is that they're suggesting limiting about 3,200 products. Examples are painkillers, antifungal creams, eczema preparations. These items may well be cheaper to buy over the counter rather than a prescription charge in England, but those who are exempt, they will be disadvantaged.
Now, is it different in Scotland then?
Yeah, Scotland has a national minor ailment service. So those who are exempt, for example, children over 60s, pregnant women, or who have an exemption or benefit, can access these products. For example, if you come into a pharmacy, you register with the pharmacist, and then you consult the pharmacist to see if symptoms or problem can be treated in the pharmacy or whether they need to see a GP. The pharmacist then prescribes using a formulary. In other words, there are set items that we can prescribe. However, there are anomalies. The system at the moment is, say you're a diabetic or you have a thyroid complaint, you are exempt under the service. But if you have a heart condition or asthma, you're not. Apart from, as I say, unless you're over 60 or under 16. Ironically, Scotland is going to open up the minor ailment service to a larger number of people, also expand the formulary. One thing we're trying out in one of the health boards is prescribing an antibiotic for uncomplicated urinary tract infection, and also being able to give a cream for the start of impetigo. Now, that's quite a nasty skin infection that we see sometimes in children, and it can spread very quickly if it's not treated right away.
It's very infectious as well, isn't it?
Yes, I've often got a young chap or a young girl in the pharmacy, and I've actually phoned the surgery to try and get them seen quickly, because as you say, it does spread very, very quickly.
Would you like to see this kind of system spread out down towards England in that way as well?
Yes, I think there are areas in England where this is happening, but the professional bodies in England were put forward a very strong case for a national service. Sandra Gidley, that's the chair of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society English Board, or England Board, although she agrees that people can self-care, so in other words, they can go into the pharmacy, ask for advice and buy products. But clearly, as she says, expecting everyone to pay for medicines for common conditions, that will further increase health inequalities and worsen, in fact, the health of patients who can't afford them.
So is this all about money, do you think?
Seemingly, the review is part of a cost-saving initiative. They're talking about delivering efficiencies of $400 million a year from this. My thoughts are that the GP will perhaps be left prescribing a more expensive item, first of all, because the patient has delayed seeing the GP. And secondly, if the patient can't afford to buy something, it could escalate and a more expensive product is needed to treat the condition. If you take something like eczema, the basic treatment is moisturising, and they're talking about cutting back on these products. If you don't moisturise liberally, literally all the time, then you can end up with flare-ups, which need to be treated with steroids or even more costly items. So I'm just wondering if they've really thought this through.
Look at my skin. Look at that.
Like a baby's.
There you go. Do babies what? Now, I believe there was actually a report out, wasn't there, about how to support patients with sight loss in the pharmacy?
Yeah, this was a joint report from the RNIB Medicines Use and Safety Team and Moorfields Eye Hospital. It was teaching the pharmacy team, that's us, how to interact with those that are visually impaired and how to offer support. A case study with pharmacy staff suggested we need to be more aware of what's needed. Providing larger type label, for example, was not universally available. I mean, some patient medication records systems. That's the labelling system that we have. Sometimes we're just not able to produce these larger print labels. Thinking about the patient information leaflet inside the packs of medicines, they're inevitably very small print. And even if you've got excellent eyesight, it's quite difficult sometimes to read them. The suggestion is that pharmacy could go online, source the leaflet, and then print in large font. Or there is an electronic medicines compendium, which provides access to a written or, in fact, a recorded version of medication information. But other things, basic things such as if a pharmacy has a visual display to tell you when your prescription is ready, then they also need to have an audio setting, clearly. Making sure the pharmacy staff speak to the visually impaired person. These are obvious things, but this has come out of the report. But rather than the carer, which often people do, for instance, in a wheelchair or something like that, we tend to speak to the carer, which of course isn't right, and introduce ourselves and tell the person what's happening. I can imagine if you have to wait a while for a prescription, then it's good if you're told how long you're going to wait and just keep you informed. Dictating a pharmacy phone number into a mobile device is another idea, so that the patient, you can contact the pharmacy. And asking the patient, do you need any extra information on the medicine you're getting? I mean, I have one blind gentleman where we put one of his tablets in a bottle so that he can differentiate that from the others he's getting. There was even a suggestion we should give the guide dog some water. There's a guide dog in the pharmacy. I think the message is we'd like to help everyone who's visually impaired, but let us know if you're struggling or you need any extra help. Sometimes we don't know that, and it's good just to let us know, because we can give you more information if you need it.
And also, like, if I walk into a chemist, then you don't necessarily know that I've got a sight problem looking at me initially. Yes,
you're absolutely right, Simon. We don't know. And it's only when perhaps we get to know you and start talking about things that you do disclose to us that you're struggling. And so please do that up front. We can help.
Another great thing that a lot of listeners have tried is a thing called PenFriend from RNIB, where you have recordable labels. And you record it, you can put it on food to go in the freezer, you can get labels for the wash, you can put it on medical things, and all you do is you then hold this up to whatever the container is, and it tells you, this is such and so, take it twice a day, blah, blah, blah. You put whatever you want on it.
Brilliant.
So that's a great idea as well. Now, changing tack slightly, quite a disturbing story. It's a headline saying that alternative cancer therapies may increase your risk of, and this isn't good, death.
Yeah, researchers were from Yale School of Medicine, and there were, however, some links between a couple of the researchers and conventional treatment companies. So we've got to remember that when we're reading through this. They matched people who chose not to have conventional treatment, and by that I mean surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, hormone treatments. These are the conventional treatments. So they were looking at these against unconventional therapy. Some of the papers suggested homeopathy, diets, herbs were used, but we don't know if the people in the study did use any particular alternative treatments. We do know, for example, that people do find acupuncture very beneficial. That's where needles are placed in particular parts of the body. So we don't want to rule out all unconventional treatments. The researchers only looked at types of cancer that would normally be treatable. In other words, they excluded those at the later stages of the disease. There were 280 participants there that were matched to 560 people with the same cancer and the same age. And because it was the United States, they were also matching with those who had insurance, because they tended to get better treatment. The types of people that decided to go for the alternatives tended to be young females. They had cancer maybe at a higher stage. They also had higher levels of education. They found that people were 2.5 times more likely to live for at least 5 years if they had conventional treatment. It also depended on the type of cancer. Breast cancer is obviously a very good survival rate. 86.6% survived 5 years with conventional treatment, as opposed to about 58% with alternatives. Prostate cancer is another one, but there's little difference when they looked at people with both conventional and alternative. And that's because prostate cancer tends to grow much, much more slowly in the first 5 years. And you've got to remember, because of this type of study, the fact that some people who chose alternatives had poor survival rates. I tend to put all of this in the middle. I tend to be all in the middle of this, which means that when someone, for instance, comes into my pharmacy who's just been diagnosed with cancer, first of all, they're usually upset, they're confused, they've got lots of questions. I've got a little library of books, for example, and what I do is I lend them out a book which maybe says beat cancer with diet, or maybe says what supplements should I take. And I think you can do a lot yourself to make sure your body's ready for chemotherapy or radiotherapy or whatever it is. And so, for example, if I can mention one author, Chris Woolens, what happened was he gave up his work to look after his daughter who had brain cancer, actually. And he's now become a real expert in alternatives, and he even helps consultants where patients are going through conventional treatments, and he gives advice. So what I'm saying is, don't just put, well, let's just put unconventional treatments to one side. I think you can work with both.
Fair enough. Another topic, another headline actually. Vitamin B3 was found not proven to prevent miscarriage. But the headline actually suggested that it could, didn't it?
Yeah. Researchers were from several countries. They looked at genetic sequencing in families with children born with multiple defects. There were four families in the study, and they took that information and then studied mice with the same disease-causing mutations, and added vitamin B3. So some of the genetic mutations affected the production of NAD. Now, that's a nicotinamide analogue, a vitamin B analogue. The researchers found two genes that could be the ones included in miscarriage and birth defects. But to then suggest that adding vitamin B3, you could stop defects and miscarriage, was a bit of a leap in the dark. I mean, if a mother was found to be deficient in vitamin B3 through a regular test with her GP, it actually sounds sensible to augment that level with some supplements. But you've also got to watch that if you take too much of vitamin B3, it can lead to liver damage. But taking foods with vitamin B3 in it's sensible, like turkey, chicken, mushrooms, green peas, another one. Taking them in a natural way, it is obviously good as an all-round diet when you're pregnant.
But the thing to remember is, if you come across a bear's liver, don't eat it all because it'll kill you. There's far too much vitamin B in there. Just in case. Now, staying on the supplements though, are the supplements that pregnant women can take safely?
Yeah, I think we now recognise that pregnant mothers should take folic acid, for example, for the first 12 weeks, and also vitamin D right through the pregnancy, and in fact into breastfeeding as well. But it is important not to take, for example, vitamin A, because that can cause birth defects. But we know that the risk of miscarriage is just by avoiding smoking, alcohol, eating a healthy diet. That is really the best advice for mums. And please ask, if you are going to supplement, please ask in the pharmacy before you do, just in case you're maybe not taking the right product.
Great advice there. Lots to think about as well. If you have anything that's come to your mind with listening to what Elizabeth's been saying there, then don't hesitate to get in touch, or you can get in touch with Elizabeth directly. It's the pharmacy, which is all the W's.
ulifepharmacy.co.uk.
And you also have another website, don't you? Which is
another
a lot
two.
Of stuff.
newlifehealthcare.co.uk and erqualitylifesystem.co.uk. So I'm busy.
And there's some good audio on there as well, though.
Yes, there is.
Elizabeth, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot, Simon.